Before I begin this episode, I just want to alert you to the fact that later on, you'll be hearing references to the death of a baby. Sometimes it comes down to luck. If there's a reporter in court when you're on trial. If it's a widely publicised crime, the court will be full of reporters. But on another day, you might be lucky that there's no newspaper reporter in court and your case doesn't get picked up in the papers or published online. Because if your crime does get picked up online, it could follow you and eventually expose you.
October 2011, she was sentenced having admitted fraud.
That's exactly what happened to the woman at the centre of this series. She was put on trial. There was a reporter in court and the case ended up in the papers and online.
We heard of how she conned a childless couple out of their savings.
Because of this report, that's how the world knows who Carrie Jade Williams really is. I'm Justine Stafford. From RTE Documentary on One, this is The Real Carrie Jade. Episode 2. I'm Sam Cooks. The woman who we met in episode 1, Carrie Jade Williams, that's a false identity, an alias. Carrie Jade does not exist. The real woman behind that identity is Samantha Jade Cooks, or Sam Cooks. When we met Carrie Jade in 2021, we had no idea that 10 years earlier, in October 2011, she'd been on trial for fraud in the north of England. This was after she had offered her services as a surrogate mother to a couple who wanted to have a baby. The Northern Echo newspaper led the reporting on the case.
The court heard that she'd seen online that a childless couple had been considering surrogacy.
Their courts and crime reporter is Bruce Unwin.
They'd had IVF treatment, which had failed, and it was their sort of last gasp attempt to try and have a child.
Sam Cooks knew this couple were desperate to have a child, and she presented herself as the ideal solution to their problem.
She claimed to have all these qualifications. She provided documents purporting to show she was a social worker with an honours degree.
Not only did Sam Cooks present qualifications, but she also said she'd already been a surrogate mother for another woman. And that woman gave a glowing recommendation of Sam as a possible surrogate for the couple.
This woman called Claudia Bronwyn, and she referred to Samantha as having an incredible heart, and she's given us the wonderful gift of our daughter, Lily.
If the couple went online, they could see all about Claudia and her new family. All made up by Sam. There was no Claudia Bronwyn. Sam took money from the couple for expenses and fees, and kept coming back for more.
To things like a surrogacy contract, health insurance upgrade, and even purchasing an insemination kit. And eventually they started to get suspicious because she began to avoid their calls, and the police were brought in, and all her claims about being a social worker and a surrogate were found to be fake.
In court, Sam pleaded guilty. In her defence, her lawyer said that she only scammed the couple because she herself had suffered a dreadful tragedy in her own life relating to her firstborn child. She had told us about this tragedy when we met her in Kerry, but because so much else she told us turned out to be fake, we initially thought this was also made up. Not so, according to what her lawyer told the court.
In 2008, she lost a child through cot death at only 4 months old.
This really did happen. Sam Cooks was just 20 years old when her first child tragically died. An unspeakable loss in the life of any young mother.
Counsel representing her said even today when she looks back, she doesn't see offering surrogacy as a bad thing, but she immediately became involved in a deception, which she now truly regrets.
Then a letter from Sam Cooks was read out in court.
Saying she's now receiving intensive therapy.
I can see I never dealt with my grief after my daughter's sudden death, and I'm sorry, this caused me to hurt other people. I hope to resolve my mental illness. This will never erase my mistake, though. Never again will I get myself into trouble. I never want to hurt anyone else again.
Sam was convicted, and in summing up, the judge talked about the effect her fraud had had on the couple.
He says, "You've pleaded guilty to a very cruel and hurtful fraud.
Your victims were particularly vulnerable because their natural and unfulfilled desire was to have children. You were clearly carrying out a deception. There was a great deal of sophistication and deliberation about that deception. You told them quite falsely. You're a court-approved social worker, and you told them you were a member of a respectable organization. Childlessness overcome through surrogacy. All wholly bogus. And it is little wonder to me that the wife in particular, having realized she was misled in such a cruel way, has suffered quite serious psychological consequences."
The judge ordered Sam to pay £1,800 to the childless couple. As well as that, because of the harm she caused to vulnerable people, he sentenced her to 9 months in prison. But in sentencing, he said this to Sam.
"There's a psychiatric report revealing a very complex emotional background to your offending. And in particular, in November 2008, you suffered a terrible bereavement. When your four-month-old baby succumbed to cut death, you clearly needed counselling. That counselling was not available, and you suffered quite serious depressive consequences from that bereavement because of this complex psychological and emotional background. I'm prepared to suspend the sentence, which otherwise I would have imposed immediately."
Suspended sentence. The duped couple who Sam tricked never publicly identified themselves. However, they did issue a comment.
"We're annoyed she didn't get a harsher punishment. It's just a slap on the wrist after all the hurt she has caused."
Sam didn't go to jail because her baby had died. And that was the reason given for why Sam started telling lies. If only that were true. To begin to make sense of everything, we need to go right back to the start of Sam's story. Even though she told us she was born in a mother and baby home in Ireland and adopted by a single woman, she was, in fact, born to a married couple in 1988. They named her Samantha Jade Cooks. Friends and family simply called her Sam.
"We had a family business that was in diamond cutting abrasives."
Her family weren't millionaires. She actually grew up in an ordinary housing estate on the outskirts of Gloucester in the west of England. Our producer Ronan travelled there. The family have long since moved out of the estate, but it does give you some sense of her actual background.
"It's between the motorway you can hear in the background and the city centre. And it's quiet, very quiet. Houses look like they were built in the 1980s. There's a row of single-storey bungalows, and opposite them are a number of two-storey, what looked like two or three-bedroomed houses. Red-bricked, semi-detached, fairly small. Quite ordinary, the kind of estate you'd see all over Britain and certainly some in Ireland as well. And this is where she spent her childhood."
Sam Cooks lived on that housing estate from the late 80s to the 2000s. One of her cousins, who lived nearby, is Natalie Cooks.
"The times that I did see her was shy. She seemed quite shy. That was at my nan's flat. We'd go there to pick her up. And they were there visiting. It wasn't very often. None of us are really close."
Years later, when Sam started appearing in the media, Natalie didn't actually recognise her.
"I think she sounds a lot posher than a Gloucester accent."
"Oh, we're going to have such a mild winter this year. Oh, come on, I'm just the eternal optimist."
"There's quite a Bristol tone to us with the errs and the like that on the end of everything. And she didn't sound like that."
"You know, I always say I'd rather pay a doctor than an undertaker."
Sam may have learned her accent in school.
"You know, I went to Steiner School."
That's not true. She went to a conventional secondary school in a wealthier suburb on the other side of Gloucester.
"And I'm looking at a large Victorian red brick building, very elaborate, standing in its own ground, surrounded by trees. And this was her secondary school, a prestigious secondary school in the area, all girls school."
One of those girls spoke to us. She was a classmate of Sam's. She didn't want to record with Ronan, but she did tell him what she remembers of Sam in school.
"There were constant stories of drama. So she said, for example, they were in a textiles class And Samantha talked about being able to bring in a sewing machine into class. And then the next day when she came in, she said that she didn't have the sewing machine because she fell down the stairs with the sewing machine and the sewing machine went flying out the window. And after several of these stories, her classmates just took them all with a pinch of salt. And I said to her, well, did she do this for attention? And this woman told me no, because she said it was an all-girls school, we were all very friendly, and Samantha, like all of them, they all had friends. They didn't need to do this to have friendships. She said the other very odd thing that she used to do was she used to carry around notebooks and write down things that people told her. And they wondered, was she doing this in order to keep track of lies that she had told so that she couldn't be caught out again?
This tendency to make up dramatic stories happened outside school too. When she was a teenager, Sam had long blonde hair and a winning smile. She had several boyfriends. They also experienced her lies, and we've spoken to some of them.
She was so sweet. She was so lovely for 4 or 5 months. And then it turned into a bit of a horror story, really.
These are the words of one of Sam's boyfriends, voiced up. Because even though it's almost 20 years later, he still does not want to be publicly identified. It's also a part of his life he's tried to leave behind. He asked us to call him John.
She became an absolute compulsive pathological liar. Things like, oh, at the weekends I work with disadvantaged children. And then you find out 4 or 5, 6 weeks later that she didn't. She would tell me that her mum was seriously ill with cancer and that she'd lost all her hair. And then the week after, I'd meet her mum and she'd be fine.
For Sam's mother, she warned everyone that Sam was a liar, including John.
She said to me in front of Sam, she's a compulsive liar. She does this. Watch out. Be careful.
We sent a message about this podcast to Sam's mother through a mutual contact. But so far, we've heard nothing back. Sam's mother has told people that she believes Sam has been going around hurting others for years and needs to be stopped. For John, her former boyfriend, he did confront Sam.
And she'd cry and I'd forgive her. And I continued going out with her. And everyone else could see it. All my friends could see it. And they were like, what are you doing with her? She's lying to you about so many things.
And despite what anyone said to him, he wouldn't be warned away from Sam.
I saw it as her trying to impress me. And I thought it was quite sweet. And I thought, okay, that made me feel quite proud and wanted. And I hadn't had a girlfriend before that. So that's why I kept going back, because I saw this naive youngster finding her way and I was able to help her.
Also, the lies. They weren't about him, and anyway, he didn't take them all that seriously.
They were nasty, but they weren't ever criminal. You know, she never sort of did me out of any money or anything like that. She would talk about having a horrible childhood when she was younger and you just nodded and went, yeah, okay, okay. And I would check with her mother. And the mum was like, no, no, look, I've told you she's a compulsive liar. That's not true. That's certainly not true.
And being Sam's boyfriend meant John was brought into this whole new world conjured up by Sam's mind.
It was a fantasy world that she lived in. And it wasn't as if she was conniving. It just all fell naturally to her. She was really good at it. She was Oscar winning. What I find so astonishing is how brazen. You know, it takes a huge amount of effort to lie and to maintain that lie. I mean, it's astonishing, you know, that she can do it so naturally and be so bloody good at it as well.
Even though John's relationship with Sam was relatively fleeting, the effect of her lies and of being in a relationship where he was constantly lied to, that's left a lasting impact on him.
It's made me into this very cynical person that I don't particularly like about myself. And I blame that purely on her.
And that's the thing about lying. You start making people around you skeptical and unsympathetic. Remember Sam's classmate from secondary school? When Ronan asked her about Sam being convicted for conning the childless couple, this is what she had to say.
Yes, she was shocked that she had ripped the people off for money, but she wasn't shocked that she had managed to persuade them. She said that's something she remembers. She was so charming that it didn't surprise her that she was able to persuade these people to part with their money, that she was going to actually have a child for them.
And we get that. Sam being charming and persuasive. After all, when she emailed us to tell her story as a terminally ill Carrie Jade Williams, we headed off and recorded her. And yet, she must have known that we'd check out her stories and find out she was lying to us. Here's an example. During the interview, she told us about an other boyfriend she'd had, who she'd met after she became an evangelical Christian.
So you met him through the church?
I met him through the church.
That's not true. They didn't meet through the church. They met socially.
What's his name?
Am I allowed to say?
Of course, yeah.
Oh, so his name was Philip.
His name isn't Philip.
And then in our faith, you wouldn't live together until you're married. So we got married.
Also not true. They didn't get married. They started going out in the summer before Sam went to college. We spoke to this boyfriend too. And like the last man, when he went out with Sam, he was faced with a steady stream of untruths. But his story had a very different outcome.
She invited me to this barbecue at her house.
We're calling him Matthew.
And it was going to be a vegan barbecue because all her friends were vegan.
And again, his words, but not his voice.
And then, the day off, she messages and says, "Oh no, it's not happening, it's cancelled." And then I find out that none of her friends were going to the barbecue. It was just another sort of unnecessary lie to me.
But like many people who came in contact with Sam's lies, Matthew made excuses. He thought it was him, not Sam, that was the problem. He thought that he just hadn't enough experience of women yet.
I thought maybe she's a bit kooky or something. Maybe this is the way some people are.
And again, like the previous boyfriend, Matthew got plenty of warnings about Sam.
And there was a woman there in our group and she went to school with Sam. And she said she couldn't be trusted. That was the phrase. You can't believe a word that comes out of her mouth.
Matthew and Sam broke up shortly after she went to college. But how she tells the story, at least to us, is that they eventually got married and settled down.
Life was good. Yeah, and then I had my little girl.
What age were you when she was born?
So it was I was 21, just after my 21st.
Exciting.
Oh, it was very exciting. Yeah, no, she wasn't planned. She was a bit of a surprise, but a happy surprise.
That part of the story is true. Sam found out she was pregnant in March 2008. She only realised it 22 weeks into the pregnancy. Given his experience of Sam lying to him, you can imagine Matthew's reaction when Sam told him that she was expecting.
I didn't really believe it because of everything else and all of the other strange things that happened. It was a little bit after and I thought, no, I just didn't really entertain her or anything. Have I just ignored her and cut her off?
Sam was 19 at this point. Matthew was still 18. Sam had cried wolf so many times about so many things and initially Matthew was okay about not believing her.
She mentioned it to somebody, I'm sure at the time, saying, "She's told me she's pregnant." I remember them saying, "Yeah, I don't believe it either." I don't know, I was kind of confused, I suppose.
But then he began to feel uneasy, especially when other people also began to tell him Sam was pregnant.
And then they were saying she's born, and I still didn't really believe it.
In July of 2008, Sam gave birth to a daughter, Martha Isabella. Matthew was now in another relationship.
And so then it was just out of the blue that my partner messaged and said, "I'm just saying that Martha has died."
Matthew had never met his daughter. Martha died at 4 months of age.
What age was she when she died?
Just before her first birthday. So,
the trial into Sam's surrogacy fraud was told in 2011 that Martha had died of sudden infant death syndrome, cot death. But when telling us about her death, Sam has a different story, a far more dramatic one.
She had a severe allergic reaction.
She said her baby died while they were being seen by a nurse in a public health clinic.
Was it very sudden?
Yes, she was very, very quickly. I've gone through a lot of therapy. I went through eye desensitization treatment, so I don't remember a lot of that because it was I used to get lots of flashbacks. I just remember the nurse taking her and starting CPR. And then they got her heart re-going, but she'd been dipping without oxygen for just that little bit too long. So,
after Martha died, her father, Matthew, met up with Sam and got to see photographs of his child.
She was staying in a hotel, so I met up with her in the car park. Then we looked at pictures and sort of shared information and things.
They didn't embrace or comfort each other.
She was obviously quite somber about it. She didn't act in any unexpected way, put it that way. I don't know, did we talk about it that much, to be honest. It was an extremely peculiar meeting. It was very awkward. I didn't know how I felt, so it was quite brief, to be honest.
Matthew had now lost a daughter, but then he never had had a daughter either.
Yeah, I don't know how I really feel about it, and how I feel about myself.
And 16 years later, what are his feelings about Sam? Is he angry or sympathetic?
I don't feel angry or hate or anything like that. It's just pretty confusing. Thinking, why? Why all this? Why are you going to this extent and repeating it?
Matthew didn't go to his daughter Martha's funeral. He says he was young, 18, and his head was all over the place.
I suppose my youthful innocence didn't really know what to do about it, so I just ignored it, I suppose.
Matthew also didn't feel able to go to the inquest into Martha's death. That took place in the coroner's court in Gloucester in April 2009, 5 months after her death. An inquest is not a court of law. No one is on trial. It's about establishing how someone died. Just a few weeks ago, we sought the public record of the inquest into baby Martha's death. That record was about to reveal to us that baby Martha did not, in fact, die from a cot death, but as a result of a blameless, tragic accident. At Martha's inquest, several witnesses were called. The police who investigated the case, the pathologist who examined the body, and Martha's mother, Sam. The hearing lasted 45 minutes, and we voiced up the witnesses' testimonies, as well as the coroner's comments and guidance. This is how he addressed everyone at the opening of the inquest.
The coroner's inquest is meant to do two things, really. Firstly, to ensure that a death is investigated using the terminology fully, fairly, and fearlessly. And that means that sometimes it's difficult to do things without people feeling a bit uncomfortable or their feelings feeling a bit hurt, but that's, I'm afraid, just the way it is.
The coroner then spoke to Sam directly.
Fairly means that it's got to be fair to everyone involved, and in this case, particularly you. Because one of the other purposes of the inquest is to allay suspicion, if there is any. I'm not suggesting there is any suspicion, but for that reason it's important that you're able to say no to two very simple questions.
The first witness was a police detective sergeant. She had spoken to Sam after Martha's death and read out her report for the hearing.
In March 2008, Sam Cooks informed her mother that she was pregnant. Sam only discovered at 22 weeks that she was pregnant. And at 30 weeks, she made inquiries with the Leeds and Gloucestershire Social Services with regards the feasibility of having the baby adopted when it was born. At 35 weeks pregnancy, Sam temporarily lived with her mother and her mother's partner. She had left university and had informed the university that she wants to defer her education for family reasons. The pregnancy and the birth itself was a closely guarded secret, with only four persons knowing of Martha's birth. Sam, Sam's mother, the natural father, and his mother. Social services were also aware.
The policewoman told the inquest that the previous year, the year the baby died, Sam's parents had had a bitter divorce, and Sam took her mother's side.
Sam told the police that she, especially, didn't want her father to know about the pregnancy.
Baby Martha was born on July 9th, 2008, and immediately went into foster care for 2 weeks. Then she was returned to Sam and stayed with her for 4 days. Then she went back into foster care for a week, until early August. Then she was returned to Sam until her death in November. During this time, Sam lived with Martha in a mother and baby home called Magnolia House. It's described as supported lodging for mothers-to-be and mothers with babies. The detective sergeant then told the inquest what happened on the day of November 18th, 2008. In the morning, Sam had met with an adoption social worker who had arrived with papers for Martha's adoption. The adoption social worker observed Sam caring well for Martha. And then when she was leaving, she was waved off happily by Sam, holding baby Martha. Then it was time for Martha to go down for sleep.
Sam placed Martha on her back and placed her into a V-shaped pillow. She was placed on top of the quilt, not under any sheets or quilts. Martha fell asleep, and Sam went downstairs to clean out the baby bottles and baby bath. She was fastidious about cleaning the bottles and baby bath. Within a short period of time, Sam returned upstairs and saw that Martha was still asleep on the bed. Sam lay on the bed next to Martha. Her intention was never to fall asleep. She wanted to lie next to Martha and watch her. She placed a rectangular-shaped pillow above the V-pillow so that she could rest her left shoulder area on it. This would be similar to when you lie on a bed reading a book and you prop yourself. Sam has stated to police that she had previously lay next to Martha, but never slept in a bed with her. In fact, other witnesses have stated that Sam was very concerned about overlaying and would lecture the other mothers about the dangers of overlaying. Sam would never sleep with Martha because she did not want to build a dependence bond between mother and child, the reason being that she was aware that Martha was to be adopted. Sam has told police that she then fell asleep. She had no intention of falling asleep and does not know why she woke up. Sam believes that she fell asleep at approximately 1 p.m. and awake at about 2:30 p.m. When Sam woke up, she saw that the rectangular pillow was over Martha's face and the V-shaped pillow was slightly wrapped around the neck of Martha.
The sudden death of a baby is such a traumatic event for everyone involved, including the detective sergeant giving testimony. At this point, she was unable to continue reading her report, so it was read out by a court official.
Sam pulled Martha from underneath the pillows. She was lifeless, and according to Sam, she was a funny colour. Sam then picked Martha up and went to run out of the bedroom. She went to open the door and found that it was locked from the inside. Sam then had to put Martha down and open the door. She opened the door and picked Martha up again. Sam started screaming, and the residents and workers at Magnolia House were alerted. Mary Johnson, a Magnolia House worker, then started cardiopulmonary resuscitation on Martha, and the ambulance were called. The ambulance service arrived within minutes of being called. They took Martha direct to the Accident Emergency Department for Children and performed cardiopulmonary resuscitation on Martha. Martha was medically resuscitated within 12 minutes of arriving at accident and emergency.
Martha was transferred to a larger regional hospital for acute pediatric care. At the first hospital, Sam spoke to her mother and a social worker and said
that she fell asleep and woke to find Martha lifeless. She said words like, "We went to sleep, I woke up and she was blue." Sam was completely traumatized and remained at the bedside of Martha.
Baby Martha died the following day, November 19th, 2008. She was 19 weeks old, 4 months. After some time, the detective sergeant was able to resume her evidence to the inquest.
Sam was a mother, and a bond had been established between Sam and Martha that was bigger than anyone could have imagined. Sam blames herself for the death of Martha, and social services are aware of the need for Sam to receive support in the following months.
The policewoman then told the inquest that, as part of her investigation, she'd attended a multi-agency meeting about Sam and Martha. This included social services. The general agreement of the meeting was that, in Sam's care for Martha, there were no obvious neglect issues. The meeting thought that everything was pointing towards this being a tragic accident. The detective sergeant's evidence was clear and unambiguous. She believed that baby Martha had died accidentally.
"I now feel that this was a tragic accident, and Sam Cooks will forever blame herself for the death of her daughter."
Then the coroner called Sam to give evidence. She can be heard crying as she's sworn in. The coroner tells her that he'll only ask her 2 questions, and she doesn't have to give long answers.
"Did you know that you could change your mind about the adoption at any time, right up until the last minute?"
"Yes."
"So that as far as you were concerned, although you'd signed this paperwork, you knew that you could change your mind?"
"From my perspective, that was just a step forward. It was to get the social services to move things along."
"Okay, then the next question is a harder question, but it's a question that should be put for fairness to you. Did you do anything on that day to deliberately harm your daughter?"
"No!"
"Okay, very well. Thank you very much indeed."
Next on the stand is a doctor, a pediatric pathologist. He explains that he can find no medical reason for Martha's death. That, for example, her heart may have stopped and circulation to the brain was cut off. He said that, given the amount of time the baby was without oxygen, such a natural cause of death was impossible to prove. He did say that baby Martha definitely did not die from sudden infant death syndrome, also known as cot death. He also says he discovered no previous occasions where the baby suffered a loss of oxygen or blood to the brain. Nor, he said, did they find evidence of deliberate obstruction of the baby's airway, as evidenced by bruising around the face. At this point, the coroner gives his first clear indications of his thoughts, and he says that he's going to discount any deliberate actions by Sam. He explains that he wants Sam to know this, so as not to cause her any more anxiety at the inquest. He then went on to summarise the evidence and give his findings.
On a balance of probabilities, I'm satisfied that Martha's death occurred because of the pillow and not because of some natural cardiac event which has not been disclosed. And I'm satisfied that the appropriate verdict that I should record in relation to Martha is that she died an accidental death. It simply then remains for me to offer my condolences to the family and to Miss Cooks, you in particular, in the usual way.
So, the inquest into baby Martha's death ruled that she died accidentally. After that, Sam tried to move on with her life. She tried to enroll back into a university, but it didn't work out. Baby Martha died at the end of 2008. The inquest took place in 2009. In 2010, Sam Cooks was living in Shropshire, near to where she'd grown up.
I'm in the town of Telford in Shropshire in the United Kingdom, and it's over near the border with North Wales, the British Midlands, and I'm in a small housing estate called Ferndale Drive, which is very like the housing estate that Samantha grew up in. It's slightly wealthier, detached red brick houses built in the 1980s, and the address in Telford is the first time, if you look up Samantha Cooks online, that you see her name in the news, because when she lived here, she ended up in court because of a fraud she committed.
That was the trial we told you about earlier, in which Sam was convicted of conning a childless couple out of their savings by pretending to be a surrogate mother for their baby. Although she was convicted, the court decided not to jail her because she had lost a baby 3 years previously. The court was told that the baby had died a cot death, which, according to the inquest, was not the case. Sam's conviction for surrogacy fraud really shocked her family, according to her first cousin, Natalie.
I remember hearing from my dad, it'd been in the paper and things. I was just like, I'm like disgusted by that.
Sam's own father felt very let down by the news that his daughter was now a convicted fraudster. Sam had already lost her daughter, and now she was about to lose her father.
He disowned Sam when the surrogacy scandal came out. I don't think he had anything to do with it after that.
Sam was convicted of surrogacy fraud in 2011. A few years later, her father received a cancer diagnosis. It was terminal.
And did he see her before he died?
No.
Oh.
They did ask him if he wanted to see her, because they knew the time was come. And he said no.
Wow, his own daughter.
Yeah. He was that disgusted by it.
Throughout all of the time her father stopped speaking to her, Sam continued living her own life. Not long after she was convicted for the surrogacy fraud in 2011, she met another man and fell in love. She became pregnant again, and at the age of 24, gave birth to her second child. Our producer Ronan made contact with this man, the father of Sam's second child.
He says that he's very unhappy at the events that took place after his child was born. I should explain here that while other people in this podcast series have asked for their identities to be hidden for a variety of personal reasons, this man has no choice in the matter. He explained to me that his child was put into his sole care to protect it from Sam, and this was done by the courts. And because it's a case involving a minor, he and we have to be extremely careful that nothing about the child's identity could be revealed, which is why we're not even mentioning its gender. I only communicated with the father by text. However, in his text messages, he managed to convey his anger at the social services. He says that his baby was being cared for by Sam, but that UK Social Services decided she was unfit to mind the child and applied to have it removed from her care. Social Services brought in an expert witness who examined Sam and said that she suffered from pseudologia fantastica, the formal term for pathological lying. The social workers argued in court that Sam's pathological lying would pose a developmental risk to her child, and the court agreed.
And her child was removed from her care and placed solely in the custody of its father.
However, the father of the child told us that he thinks things could have been done differently. Sam and he needed support, he says, not to have Sam removed from her child's life. He acknowledges there were mental health issues at play, but he feels taking the care of the child from Samantha was what he called an overreach by the social services. Social services, of course, felt they were acting in the best interests of the child.
After her child was taken from her, there was another development in Sam's life. No one else knew, neither Sam's partner nor social services, that she was pregnant again. Her third pregnancy. It's impossible to imagine what Sam was thinking. She'd lost her first child to cot death. Now her second child had been removed from her care. Looking back now, it was clear she was going to do something. Just no one knew what.
West Mercia police are appealing for help from the public as they attempt to trace a woman who's missing from Shrewsbury.
West Mercia covers the counties in England along the border with Wales. This was 2013. The woman the police were looking for was Sam.
24-year-old Samantha Cooks, who is from Meal Brace, was reported missing on Saturday the 28th of September, but has not actually been seen since the 21st of September. Samantha is described as being around 5 foot 6 inches tall and as having long brown hair when she went missing. Speaking about Samantha's disappearance, Detective Inspector Phil Shakechef said, "Our extensive inquiries now lead us to believe Samantha has been in Ireland. More specifically, we believe she's been in Dublin and also a small village called Clane in County Kildare in recent times."
The police were right. Sam did end up in Ireland. When we interviewed her, this is what she told us about coming to Ireland and to a suburb in South County Dublin.
As a family, we had a little apartment in Glenageary, and we have really good family friends who I call aunt and uncle.
Sam does have relations in Ireland, but not in Dublin. And they're not family friends she calls auntie and uncle. They're her real aunt and uncle. But the main reason Sam came in 2013 wasn't to visit family. She came because, having had her second child already taken off her by UK Social Services, she didn't want the same thing happening to her third baby. Sam gave birth to her third baby here in Ireland. Shortly after its birth, Irish Social Services went to the Family Law Court here, and a ruling was made that the baby should be taken from Sam and returned to the full-time care of its father in the UK. That was in 2014. So by then, having given birth to three children, Sam was on her own. Her first child had accidentally died, and her following two children had been removed from her care by the authorities here and in the UK. And so, from then, 10 years ago, right up to today, Sam has moved around Ireland, positioning herself to take care of other people's children. All the time hiding from them that twice she's been found unfit to care for her own children. Before we find out what happens next in the story of Sam Cooks, we need to briefly go back to one of her first set of victims, the couple who fell for Sam's surrogacy scam. The fact that the case was publicised was bad news for Sam Cooks, but good news for the couple, as it turns out.
Their plight was picked up locally by a wealthy businessman,
Bruce Unwin, court reporter.
And he paid for another bout of IVF treatment, which was a success, and they gave birth to a baby girl. So, for at least for them, there was a happy ending, as it were, despite the trauma and the ordeal they'd suffered at Samantha Cook's hands.
One other thing from that court case. Remember what Sam told the judge after her custodial sentence was suspended?
"Never again will I get myself into trouble. I never want to hurt anyone else again."
She completely failed to stick to that promise. Not only that, The skills she learned in conning the childless couple in England, she honed them to con a host of other families in Ireland. That's where we're going in episode 3, which is titled, I'm Lucy Fitzwilliams.
I'm sitting on the end of the bed and I never forget it. My husband was in the wardrobe and he was clearing the clothes out. And honest to God, my blood just ran cold, literally cold.
If you've been affected by any of the themes in this episode, please reach out to rte.ie/helplines, where you'll find contacts for a variety of support networks. If you have any knowledge of Samantha Cooks, a.k.a. Carrie Jade Williams, Sadie Harris, Lucy Fitzwilliam or Rebecca Fitzgerald, please contact us immediately and in confidence by email to documentaries@rte.ie or on any of the RTE Documentary on One social media platforms. The Real Carrie Jade is narrated by myself, Justine Stafford. Music is composed by Fergal O'Connor and performed by Fergal and Tony O'Flaherty. The sound engineer is Ruth Kennington. The series is produced by Ronan Kelly and Liam O'Brien with the team from RTE Documentary on One.